scalar field or a vector field, center field, whatever. But for a scalar field in particular, phi prime at x prime minus phi at x is zero.
Right. What you're looking at when you look at this is, okay, right, a scalar field, the field itself doesn't change. It's not a vector that's going to rotate under a Lorentz transformation or something. It just has the value. The only thing it has is the value. So if your Lorentz transformation also takes x to x prime, you're looking at the same function of x prime as you had of x back here, and nothing changes. So what he defines is this, what he calls del zero, is looking at phi prime at x minus phi at x. So you don't change the point. And it's very unclear reading what he says, what this thing is. It's a Lie derivative. He's taking the Lie derivative in the direction of the symmetry. That's what's actually going on here. So if you we're on some manifold, really, and, okay, so it's flat space-time, and it's all even very symmetrical, but still, it's a manifold. And a coordinate transformation, we have some point x. The coordinate transformation is going to take x in some symmetry direction. Okay, Lorentz transformation does a rotation, so, you rotate x in the phi direction. Okay, that's the direction of one of the symmetries of space-time. Or do a translation, all right, so we translate. But for any specific transformation we can do, a particular boost or something, we're doing a... it induces a motion on the coordinates of space, and so that gives us a set of curves. Or at any point, it gives us a set of vectors for each of the different transformations. Those are the group generators, the vectors. So we've seen this before in a very different guise. But so here's what he's doing. Right? The Lie derivative is a way of, if we have some phi, and we now transform it to some phi prime at x prime, okay, what he wants to do is Lie drag it back. So he wants to look at that transformed field and compare at the same point, and you're using Lie dragging to do it. So the motion induced by the coordinate transformation, the symmetry transformation, gives us a means of comparing a field at two points. So we're seeing how that field changes when we do this particular symmetry transformation. So we're looking at the change in the field here. And that's what this variation is. So we drag it back. And then he goes on to write this thing as phi prime at the new point minus the small displacement, I guess we call this del x here, minus phi of x. And we show that, if del x is given by a Lorentz transformation, we've got some parameters here, and we've got some generator of Lorentz transformations. What are they? JABs, I guess. And we have a particular form for these matrices. You know, these are some matrices that act on the coordinates to give the small change. This is an infinitesimal group transformation, so just a generator. Right, the infinitesimal group element, or a group element in the neighborhood of the identity is 1 plus this. Del x is, right, that gives x plus this thing. Then we're subtracting the x to get del x. So we combine that with a Taylor series of this, and putting it all together last time, we found the form of the transformation, and let me just write the result of that. I'm almost there. Let me do it. Let me do the Taylor series. So, have it fresh in mind now. Del zero of phi, this is for a scalar field this time, is
this difference, so we have 5 prime at x, we're doing a Taylor series, so that's equal to this, so it cancels. Then minus del x mu du of 5 prime at x prime, or phi of x, the equivalent thing. So del phi is this, since we've got a del x and we've got a partial derivative. We combine these two, substituting this expression, let me keep my Greek and Latin indices distinct here. So del x mu is x mu nu x mu. So this is an infinitesimal Lorentz transformation. These are arbitrary real parameters, and that's our generator as a matrix that acts on x. And this becomes dinner. Thank you. A, B. This matrix turns out to be eta A mu delta B nu minus eta A or B B nu delta A nu. Right. It's a generator for the Lorentz group, and we found that they look like this. It's the index position. Everybody remember that? Lorentz generator. Okay, so we put that in here. Maybe times a factor, maybe not, but let me just do this. We could normalize these differently if we wanted to. Then, that acting on x nu and d mu, all acting on phi. So that's the change we get. And if we carry out these contractions, we have some linear combination here. Okay, mu becomes an a up, nu becomes a b up. So we have xb partial a minus, and then this becomes xa partial b. And it's just this expression we've seen before, most of the time, for an angular momentum, orbital angular momentum, star-cross p. We know somewhere in the back of our minds that p is just a gradient. Actually, I think you proved that in the next section, so probably speaking, it doesn't look like our cross p yet, but this thing is then LAB, the orbital angular momentum operator, in a field representation. So, orbital angular momentum LAB or mu nu, I haven't been careful here with my indices, x mu d mu minus x mu mu. It's a generator. We can normalize it any way we find convenient. So I won't worry with the normalization here. He picks something particular. Oh, and he puts an I on it. He has an overall I because he wants it to be Hermitian. So now the interesting case all of the rest of the cases are similarly interesting. Right. We can ask the same questions for spinners or for vectors or for any rank tensor we want. And now the story is slightly different than this, but in all those cases it's pretty much the same. What happens is phi prime is now, phi is a spinner, say. So when you do a Lorentz transformation, you also do a Lorentz transformation of the components of a spinner. So, if we have, a spinner, say we have a left-handed spinner, we know that the components of that mix was one of these lambda L things, where this was an exponential of polymatrices and the parameters, right? And lambda right was a slightly different linear combination of polymatrices. Or if we were doing a Dirac spinner, we would have gamma matrices, the next exponential of commutators of gamma matrices. If we're doing a vector, the components, all right, we have these 4x4 matrices that tell us how to rotate space-time vectors. So even at a point, even if we just have an isolated vector, we know that its components shuffle this way. But now, what happens is, say, V alpha prime at x prime is going to be some lambda alpha beta V beta at, you know, some lambda x. We get all of this. So both the point moves and the components of the object are rotated. Depends on the kind of object. So for any of the fields we're allowed, spinner, vector, tensor fields, okay, general rank n tensor fields, we're going to have n factors like this lambda. For a bispinner, we'll have, you know, two of these SU2 representations. But we know how those components rotate, and we know what that transformation is. So if we want to find the generator of, we want to find the form of the angular momenta, or the Lorentz generators in general, we're going to have two pieces to it. We're always going to have this. This comes from the change in the component, and change in the coordinates. That's the lead dragging thing. But also, even at that point, this point here, we're going to rotate vectors by our boost, or our rotation, whatever. So we do both. So, in addition to this, we're going to have what? Intrinsic spin, right? So, let's just do one calculation like that. Let's take the spinner case. So, for a spinner, we want del naught of, say, a left-handed spinner. And what that is 5 prime at x minus phi at x. And this time, we have two transformations to write down. Let me just see. Once again, we write this as x prime minus the del x, phi l of x. We do a Taylor series again, so phi l prime at x prime minus del x mu d mu phi l prime at x prime. We're going to neglect second order stuff, so we can regard this as just being phi at x, the original one, minus phi l of x. There's really a key thing here that the plan of an l on phi, but that's infinitesimal too. So we'll discard the two infinitesimals. But now, this combination is just lambda L on phi L minus phi L. So lambda L minus 1 phi L minus del x mu d mu phi L x. This is just the generator of this representation of the transformation. So, all right, we know what these are. So this is some polymatrix thing, right? This is just what do we have to initiate to do it? Does it have it written down here? It's lambda L is e to the 1/2 some parameters with S mu nu, where for the gamma, for for a full Dirac spinner, this would be a commutator of two Dirac spinners. For the left and right-handed spinners, we've done the two-component job. It's we derived it the other day. It's that linear combination of Pauli matrices that makes it left-handed. So it's this minus I theta minus A. Pauli for some normalization is a half. So it's that thing that we figured out for the way that left-handed spinners transform under a Lorentz transformation is that. So this is lambda L. Then for an infinitesimal set of parameters, theta and eta, those parameters are just this W. Where did the W go? Back here somewhere. There was a W. Those parameters, or these parameters. This is one, say minus a half, I, that's one minus delta, whatever the parameters are, dot sigma. Okay, this sigma is a matrix in some two-dimensional space that acts on the components of this phi L. So this thing, or the one cancels, and we're left with something we will call S mu, the I've already defined it. So S mu nu is this with these parameters here. So what we get is del naught of phi L is going to be a sum of two terms. We'll have S mu nu, we have W mu nu over 2, S mu nu plus L mu nu acting on our left-handed piece. So the full expression for the branch transformation includes an intrinsic spin and an orbital angular momentum, or corresponding things in the Boost case, although those are not conserved quantities, so they're not quite as important for them. Okay, had to do with all that.
I got most of it, actually, surprisingly enough.
Okay, cool. Any questions? You can read through this in the text, but this is what he's doing, and he's tenderly derivative. So we're finding how the field changes under lead transport in a symmetry direction. I could talk about the representation, sort of massive particles and massive particles. I think you can read that on your own. I'm going to start on the field. Let's start with Hamiltonian dynamics in field theory. And a different marker. The black actually colored that better, doesn't it?
No.
Alright, sorry, I'm getting it. So, any question on what's on the board? Good. Okay. So, first, a brisk refresher on Lagrangian and Hamiltonian mechanics and the Noether theorem. These, I imagine, we've looked at before. So I'm just going to through them. Then we're going to go back and do the same construction for field, which you've seen some of, but probably not so much. So mechanics. we write an action as the integral of a Lagrangian, which is a function of particle positions and velocities, possibly higher stuff, I agree with this, in time, integrated over time, from some initial to some final time. And the method for finding, the other equations here, for example, the familiar example is L is kinetic minus potential energy, half m x dot squared minus some v of x. And we know that when you give us Newton's second law when we vary it. I think you've all seen that maybe too many times. Are we getting to the point of too many times? Or but one more time, you know, it'll really come to be. How about it? You want to see that variation? Yeah, okay. All right, I'll do that. Let me do it in general, and then we'll do that example just to kind of clean it up. So, let's do the example first. Example. F is T1 to T2. Then we have a half m x dot squared minus v of x. This is good for a single particle. So if you integrate that admittedly strange-looking quantity, kinetic minus potential energy, what's that? Well, that's something. It's the Lagrangian. That's what the Lagrangian is. The point about the Lagrangian is that the variation of its integral gives the equation of motion. So if I look for halves x of t that make this functional extremal, so this is written with square brackets here because it is a functional al of the path. That is, f is a number, okay, but I can't tell you what that number is until you give me all of x of t. So it's a mapping from a function space to the real. Right? A normal function is a mapping from the real to the real, or Rn to the real. This is a mapping from a function space. You've got to give me the whole function or I don't know what this is. So it's a little bit different animal, and we've learned, I think, how to take essentially a first functional derivative. You take this at x plus some epsilon and subtract f of x, and you look at the linear terms. You drop higher order terms. And, that's the practical way that you can always work out what these things are. But in fact, it's easier than that for almost any action you're going to deal with in the near future. I've seen one where I had to get really careful, but, some fractional thing with square roots and stuff. So square roots of the integral, but I shouldn't do that. But you can figure out what these are. You can just work through the rules and you'll get the right answer. But essentially what you do is you take partial derivatives of everything with respect to x and x dot times the variation. So how does this vary when I'm, this variation of f is what happens when I wiggle x a little bit. So changing x a little bit, I'm going to get 2 times a half m x dot dotted into whatever wiggle I do here. What I do, I take the partial derivative with respect to x dot, and I dot that with the variation of x dot. For this, I get the partial with respect to the coordinates times the variation of the path x is t, like that, dt. So that's all I have to do. And it's just like taking partial derivatives. I get a factor of 2 because it's the same square. There's no magic. It's the linear term. So you're computing these things the same way you compute derivatives. Then I notice that, what do I have here? M x dot d of del x dt minus dv dxi del xi. I'm mixing conventions here. Here I'm just using a vector dot, and here I'm summing on I. But you'll tell me if that causes you any confusion. I want to integrate the first term by parts, because what I want to do is isolate a del x out here. So when I integrate by parts, I have the integral of ddt of m x dot dot del x, just del x, dt,
And then minus a term with ddt over on this stuff. So minus the integral of ddt mx dot, then I have this term still, plus the partial of z with respect to the coordinates xi. I'd better call these xi's as well, so that I can now pull out the del xi over here, integrate dt.
Is everybody here? Everybody got the integration by parts? The integral of a total derivative just gives this quantity evaluated at the endpoint. What is it? What's that give you?
Zero.
Gives me zero y.
You find it to be the same. No matter what path you take, they're the same at that point.
I hold the endpoint fixed, so del x has to be zero at the end. Exactly. Okay, so this term gives me zero. And the other term, I'm demanding that I get zero. Let's see, m is constant, so I have xi double dot plus xi here, del xi dt. This has to hold for all variations of xi. And it's not hard to show, depending on how much mathematical rigor you want, but with as much mathematical rigor as you desire, you can show that this can only be the case if the thing in brackets is zero. And so we have if and only if mx vector double dot is minus grad b. And of course that's of course, and we've got Newton's second law as long as there's a potential for the motion.
Just by the minus sign, isn't there? T minus C.
Well, yeah. You're right, trying to integrate right. By parts here, and that's where that extra sign comes in, and yes, that's
okay.
Why T minus C.
Right.
In fact, there's a better derivation. If you read my mechanics book, you'll see in there that what I do is I write a covariant version of Newton's second law, and you can show that the Euler-Lagrange equation for will give Newton's second law in covariant form, you know, if and only if you choose, you know, that particular function. So you derive it in a straightforward way. It'll look more satisfying. Fact of the matter is, any action that gives you the right equation of motion is an allowed action. And actions are useful because you can do things like Noether's theorem tells you about symmetry, lets you solve some of the equations immediately. Mechanics doesn't care. Quantum mechanics actually does, because quantum mechanics quantizes it by allowing paths near the extremal path. And if the action, if you have two different actions, you get two different quantum theories for the same particle. This is a very confusing thing. I don't know that anyone knows exactly what to make of that, except to say, well, let's choose the simplest one and see if it works. There are systems like the harmonic oscillator. In fact, I think there's a systematic way of developing an infinite number of actions that will give you any of some class of equations of motion. So there, at the very least, there are examples where you have a countable infinity of possible actions you could write. It turns out that the simplest one, the next simplest one after T minus V is horribly complicated. And they only get worse from there. So if you can avoid working with them, do so. But it's kind of cool that these things exist. Okay, that was our example. Let's go back to the general case. And as I say, this is going to amount to partial derivatives. Okay? L, in these cases, is really just a function of the positions and velocities of, you know, maybe many particles, or in this case, one particle. So, you know, we know how to We know how L wiggles when we wiggle X. It's not complicated. In fact, it is just the partial of the Lagrangian with respect to X times the variation of X plus the partial of the Lagrangian with respect to the velocities summed with the variation of the velocities. And, you know, that's it, unless you have X double dot or something in there. But this is enough. And we integrate by parts. And not to beat about the bush, we know that we're going to get minus dBt of that and throw out the surface term. So we have minus a total time derivative of the partial of L with respect to xi dot times now del x has been separated out, integral dt. We've thrown out the surface term, and we see that this is true if and only if the Euler-Lagrange equation holds. That is, the partial of L with respect to coordinates seem to equal the total time derivative of the partial of L with respect to the velocity. That thing equals zero is, in fact, the general coordinate covariant form of the equation of motion of a classical system. Because we're starting from an action integral, that action integral is the integral of some scalar. It's going to be independent of coordinate transformations. So we could have varied any coordinates and we'd still get an expression that looks like this. We have q's instead of x's would be the only difference. So it's a nicely magical expression that will work for any coordinate or chart or element of the diffeomorphism group. Okay. Okay. However many syllables you want to put in your description, that's what we got. And it'll still work. Okay, so now let's do the Hamiltonian version. We're going to let H. Well, let's define the momentum. So I define the momentum conjugate to x as the partials of L with respect to the velocity. So this is what I take to be the momentum. Notice in our example back here, the partial of this with respect to the velocity is mv. Big surprise, that's the momentum. Okay, so it's got some intuitive veracity to all this. So we press on. We let h be ti xi dot minus l. So it's related to l, but notice that the partial of h with respect to xi dot, the dependence of x on the velocity is, the thing of t is independent here, so we're just going to get ti minus dl vxi dot is, well, zero, because that's what we find ti to be. H does not depend on velocity. H depends on x, certainly, and it depends on the new variable t. So now h is a function of the position and the momentum rather than the positions and the velocities. And the advantage of this formalism is that it really treats the x's and the p's on an equal footing. A deeper advantage is that the formulation comes extremely close to quantum mechanics. this is canonical quantization. Pressing on, let's write the action in terms of this is now, the action is L, so we can write that as Ti xi dot minus h of v and x dt. And now you really think of this thing as existing in a six-dimensional space, not a three-dimensional space. So we're not talking about the position vector and the tangent vector of the curve, the velocity. What we're talking about is the momentum and position regarded as six co-equal independent variables that describe the path. So we're describing a path now not in configuration space, the space of all x, y, and z, but in phase space, the space of all x, y, z, px, py, and pz. Perfectly good space, actually. There's one very nice thing that comes out of using such a space. Newton's second law is second order, and the initial conditions say, right, you pick an initial position and an initial velocity, and now you've got a unique path. What that means is that at a given, through a given initial point of configuration space, there are infinitely many solutions to your problem. In phase space, you pick an initial point. Well, that's a six-dimensional initial point. You pick the initial position and momentum. There is only one path through that point that solves the problem. So there are single, you know, families of curves that gives the solution to your problem. It makes for a much nicer picture when you draw these things in four colors and get chaos. Alright, so we again need vary f and demand that variation be zero, but we're going to wiggle p and x. So we get a bunch of terms here. We get del p I and x I dot. We also get p I del x I dot. And we get the partial of h with respect to the x's del x I, and the partial of h with respect to the p's del p I. That's all integrated dt. And now we have at least one integration by parts to deal with, because this one's okay. This one we got to integrate by parts. This one's okay. This one's okay. So only one integration by parts here. So I'll collect the del PIs. Let's see. That one, we have two terms. We have an XI dot minus DH DPI, the last one. And then the del XI dot, okay, when I integrate this by parts, what do I get? Do it the easy way. What do I get?
Get a plus sign.
I change the sign, right? I get a sign put, and I throw the dot over on the other thing.
Dh.
This term.
P dot. You get a P dot. Minus P dot.
Times del x.
Right.
So, let's see. I can write the del xi. So minus, there's a pi dot integrating this by parts. And then this one's okay as it is. Let's pull out the minus sign, so plus the partial of h with respect to xi. Now, del p and del x are independent. I can take del x equals 0 and del p arbitrary, and that tells me that xi dot has to be equal to dh dpi. Or I can take del p to be 0 and del x to be arbitrary, and that tells me that pi dot is minus dh dxi. These are Hamilton's equations.
I have a question.
Yes.
Why do we vary them both together rather than like one at a time?
Because I can. It's because it's easy.
Oh.
I could do one at a time. That would be fine.
You get the same Hamilton's equation.
Oh, yeah.
You
really, yeah. Okay. If I only had varied del t, I wouldn't have had these two terms.
Oh, right. They'll go away. Right.
Yeah. They're just not there. Because I didn't do that wiggle or that wiggle. Yeah. So, totally equivalent. Are there other questions?
We only did a variation of one here because these are not independent variables, or
right. We treat it as a functional of one function x vector t. That the functional may depend on time derivatives of that function.
Okay. Right.
Yes, sometimes you talk about a velocity phase space and think of this as a function of x and x dot. You can do that, but it's not quite as balanced a picture as you get with the Hamiltonian. And you don't usually vary x and z independently. You figure if you know x of t, you know x dot of t. And so this picture usually you just vary.
Okay.
Okay, well, let's see, is this getting the right thing? You know, let's check our example again. If L is 1/2 M X dot squared minus D, then PI is partial of L with respect to XI dot, and you've already observed that's M XI dot. The Hamiltonian is PI XI dot minus the Lagrangian 1/2 M X dot vector squared minus plus D. And now what you do, you use this to eliminate the velocity. So you explicitly eliminate velocity, so this term is going to be t squared over m. This term is going to be, it's also t squared, but over 2m plus z. So here we get something that actually is familiar, t squared over 2m plus z, that's the total energy. And there are theorems in Hamiltonian mechanics that if the Lagrangian has no explicit time dependence, you know, there's no function of t sitting in here somewhere, then the Hamiltonian is conserved. There will be no time dependence to the Hamiltonian. And that means that energy is constant. So the way to put dissipated systems is some time dependence in there, and you can make it dissipated too. All right, so then Hamilton's equations. Give a second here. I hope Dick doesn't just die on us there. Nothing extra. you want to be careful when these systems get complicated. You know, if you have, say, more than velocities, you have, if your Lagrangian depends on higher derivatives of x, you need to be, there is a way to do it in defining Hamiltonian systems for it, but you have to be careful that you're actually reproducing the equations of motion and only the equations of motion. That would be interesting. That's not in my book. I've got to fix that part of my book. Okay. Let me go one more step with the Hamiltonian picture, just to make it a little more symmetrical. Let's define a matrix, let's call it omega, let's see, which way do I want to do it here? let's find some new coordinates first. Let's let psi A equal xi or pj for A equals 1 up to 6. So we make a six-dimensional vector out of this thing. And let's see. Not sure about my index positions, whether I'm going to get in trouble with it. I might want that one up, but let's press on. So notice that we have xi dot and pi dot in Hamilton's equations. That's the left side. That's just going to go to d psi a dt. So we can write the left side in terms of this thing very nicely. If we look at the gradient of the Hamiltonian with respect to these new phase space coordinates, we have the h, the xi, and we have the h, the pi. That looks good. The only thing that's missing is that funny minus sign here that isn't in the gradient. So what we do is we define a matrix, omega AB, and we define this thing to be, that has some minus signs in just the right places. So here we'll have minus a Kronecker, and up here we'll have plus a Kronecker, and I have to think about index positions a little bit. So let's see, this is going to be an IJ, and this is an IJ, I think. Will make my index position work out the right way. Then, I'd like to think that I'm correct when I write d psi a dt is omega ab times the partials of h with respect to the psi. And if we check that, over here we have, you know, this is minus Kronecker ij, I said, and plus Kronecker ij. And these derivatives are the h, the xj, and the h, the pj. So on the first row, I'm going to get the h, the p, the pj, Kronecker IJ, let's see. No, that's not me. That's actually an up index, so an IJ here would be just fine. So, better make these normal. That one's down, so the J ought to be up. So I think it looks like that instead. Then, the second one, we're going to get that's going to work. DH. So, this Kronecker just changes that to an I. This Kronecker changes this to an xi. And on this side, we have xi dot and pi dot. So have we got it right?
Doesn't it change? wait, something's backwards.
Oh, wait, okay. They're on the denominator.
My yeah, of P sub J in the denominator is
the
of
the index. Got it.
So I'm just flagrantly using our position conventions here without saying so. You guys all have stuff, so I'm not worried about it. Weren't there once 9 people in here?
Yeah, I was wondering where Joe and those people are.
Well, Joe emailed me. He said he couldn't make it today. And I know Neil was, I don't know what Neil's doing, but Neil didn't sit in or something.
There's Chad.
And then, yeah, Chad.
Neil's trying to work full time.
What's that?
Neil's trying to work.
Oh. Yeah, okay. All right, so, I guess it's, okay, good. Okay, so we get this very succinct form of all 6 of Hamilton's equations at the simple cost of introducing this anti-symmetric matrix. Now, omega, the inverse to this thing, we're going to write as omega AB, as a covariant rather than a contravariant vector. It's anti-symmetric. I can write it as a differential form. So I could write a two-form as one of these things, D, I, A, D, with D, I, B, for you guys all know about forms, right? This is called a symplectic form. And from this explicit form, we see that the determinant of that matrix is not equal to zero. So it's a non-degenerate matrix. And since it's constant, it's also obvious that it's closed as a differential form. This is an invertible statement. If we have a closed non-degenerate two-form on some manifold, it's a symplectic space, and we have all of the structures that are really necessary for Hamiltonian mechanics on that space. It turns out to be this object omega in which we can actually define just about all of the properties we ever need. We use probably this form to define a Poisson bracket. We define the Poisson bracket of two functions f and g to be this omega ab partial of f with respect to psi a, partial of g with respect to psi b. And I invite you to expand this out in terms of the p's and the x's and check that this is the usual form of the Poisson bracket. So two variables. And then,
why is the omega zero?
The components are all constant.
Oh, okay.
So it's trivial.
Would it give a minus one for the determinant, actually, in this case? Minus one? Or not quite?
Well, I don't know. It may depend on the dimension, even.
Okay.
You know, it's clearly not degenerate, but...
Okay.
You know, if, for example, if you square it, you get, minus the identity. So omega squared is minus the identity, so the determinant squared is minus is the determinant on it. That's
perfect anti-symmetric
for
the determinant.
Well, the eigenvalue certainly would be things like I suppose, wouldn't they? If you can raise some lower indices on this thing, if you have some independent metric around it. Then you can also use it to impose a complex structure on the space. You have something that squares to minus one. The problem is I can't square it legitimately because I've got both indices up. I need a mixed, a 1-1 tensor form in order to square it. So we don't quite see the result that way. So I don't know what that determinant is. It's not zero.
Okay.
But, yeah, you can go home and figure it out. You know how to take the determinant. It's probably like minus one in the dimension or something.
Okay.
I think that might actually work. But.
Right, okay. That's
okay, so expand this out some three. But you can write Hamilton's equation. So if you want some exercises, anybody want some exercises? Is anybody computing anything?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I've got
two of them. Good.
I'm trying to get the rest from SL2C.
So, yeah.
The boost at least. Yeah.
Alright. Let's see. So, exercise one, show that we have G, what is it here? It's going to be if that's an X, then A is 1, 2, 3, column 4, 5, 6, so that's the positive one. So I think I've got my signs right on this. Don't get too out of joint if you find the opposite sign here, but I think this is right. So compute all of these things. Xi, Xj, 0, Xi, Dj, Kronecker, Di, Tj, 0. Right. Any variables that satisfy this are called canonically conjugate variables. And, you know, given any trees with different coordinates x, you can find some p's that will satisfy these. You can, let's see, if you notice that if I take h with a function, then I get dh, dxi, df, dci, minus dh, dti, dg, dxi. But dh, dx, Hamilton's equation, which where'd they go?
Where'd the g come from? Is that
for
the f?
Oh, okay. Oh,
f.
Yeah, one more.
Dh, dx dot is what? It's, dh, dx is minus pi. So I get a pi dot here. And I've still got the df, di. Here, dhdt is xi dot. And that, by the chain rule, is almost minus the total derivative, the total time derivative of f, except that this would also include, if f actually has some explicit time dependence. So let's write df dt is equal to, this is anti-symmetric, so I could write f of h and get rid of the sign. But then I have to add any explicit time dependence. So this is true for any function f. Exercise 2 here, show that Xi, H, and Ti, H reproduce Hamilton's equation. Right. So we can write Hamilton's equations, we can define canonical variables, we can do all of that once we've got this Poisson bracket. This is called the Poisson bracket. And we can define the Poisson bracket once we've got a symplectic form.
I suppose it's called that because it looks like a fish.
No. That's what Flaçon did.
What's that?
I don't know what Flaçon looked like.
Oh.
What about fishes? I'm so far behind in it.
Poisson is the French word for fish.
Okay. So it wasn't that I was totally lost. It was that I just didn't understand what the joke was. Okay.
Sorry. Lots of times, lots of people look at me very odd. Like, what are you talking about? Okay. So I'm showing you this because, we're all going to spend some time looking at this kind of thing in our research, and so I want you to get the review of the stuff on brackets and the symplectic form. But for the purposes of field theory, anywhere that a Hamilton's equation is realm, and we're in Hankman, and we're in Dr. J. So now, in this copious time remaining to us, let's start the field theory picture of all the same stuff. So we're going to do the same thing, but we're going to vastly increase the number of degrees of freedom in a way that's under extremely good control, so it's not going to cause them any problems at all.
Hopefully. Makes it easier, right?
Yeah,
it
does.
Makes it covariant.
You can do a lot more. It's a reveal. Okay. Whenever I talk about quantization and quantum field theory or quantum mechanics, I stress the fact, just in quantum mechanics, because it's easy to confuse this point. X and P in quantum mechanics are dynamical variables. They describe properties of a particle. That is not a generic position coordinate or a generic momentum coordinate. Those are the position and momentum of some particular particle. And when you've got that firmly in mind, going to field theory is easy because, okay, our dynamical variable in particle physics, our principal one, is the position of the particle parameterized by time. We could even do this in one dimension. Let's take a one-dimensional problem. So here we have a particle parameterized by time. So a two-dimensional, space and time. Now let's go to one variable, but we're going to let it depend not just on time, but on three other parameters as well. These are parameters. That's a dynamical variable. Not the same. So, we impose quantization conditions on this dynamical variable and its conjugate momentum. There's a commutation relation those have to satisfy. The same is going to be true here. The dynamical variable will satisfy some commutation relation with its conjugate momentum. So we're going to go through, the only trick is that the dynamical variables depend on more parameters. And now, in this picture, it emerges very clearly that the coordinates are parameters, and it's the dynamical variable that we're really interested in. So, we again are going to look at an action functional. It's a functional of a function of more than one variable now. That's okay. Let's see. A typical example. Let's take a Klein-Gordon type field. So we have some derivatives of the field here. could be we have, anybody know what sign we want here? A term like that, it just depends on the field squared. The simplest sort of thing you could write, something quadratic in derivatives, quadratic in the field. Looks like a harmonic oscillator potential. It's going to act like a harmonic oscillator potential. The thing is, we want to sum this over all the parameters, so we're going to integrate these parameters. not only do we integrate time, but we integrate the space as well. You can actually think of the Lagrangian as being the integral of some Lagrange density over all of spatial position. So think of this as introducing a Lagrange density.
You use L for Lagrangian, right? Straight L for Lagrangian?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. That's the Lagrangian method.
Oh, all right. Okay. I think I see that. Okay.
Right. So then here, the integral of L dt is the integral of Lagrange density d3x dt, and that's just d4x.
Right.
Not worrying about such niceties as curved space or general coordinates or parameters. Of course, we can put all that in, and we do.
Okay, so let's see. What do we do? We did the same stuff. Let's get a field equation. See what happens. The variation of F. What happens? Well, we're going to wiggle the dynamical variables around. We're going to let them be arbitrary other functions of position and time, and see what happens. Well, we're still taking partials and doing all the same stuff. We're going to get two factors of the derivative of phi times the derivative of the variation of phi. There are undoubtedly infinitely many more variations that we're doing here than we did before, but, we don't have to write anymore to do that. And then we're going to have either plus or minus 2 times the constant squared times phi times del phi. And we're going to integrate that all before x. And I put a half there so that the 2's would nicely go away when I do this. And now we're going to integrate by parts. So let's do this one a little more carefully, since it's a surface integral and not just a line integral. We can write this as ddx. Let me do it this way. Mu of del phi times d phi dx mu. D4x. Then minus the derivative over on the other thing. So we'll have del phi, and then we have d squared phi dx mu dx. This minus sign, that means we need a minus m squared by that term, d4x. We can just take m imaginary. We have to, I forget which way the sign's supposed to come out. This thing is just a down variation of phi. And let's see, that's minus ddt. Oh, they keep using the opposite convention, so all bets are off. Anyway, let's look at the surface term, see what happens. We have the integral d4x of the divergence of something, the divergence of some four vector. That term is equal to the integral over the boundary, the closed boundary, of del phi, some outward normal to the surface, dotted into the gradient of phi, integrated over the whole surface equal to the boundary of our volume V. What we do is we hold the variation constant on the boundary, so we still get exactly what we expect to get. But we can do this other ways too. We can just assume that all surface integrals vanish. I think that's what Mangiore is going to do. He's going to assume that all the fields drop off to zero at infinity, so any surface term you get is going to be zero out there. In this case, we get it by holding the variation constant at any boundary we like. We could even take a finite boundary, and this wouldn't give us any problem with getting the field equation. It might crop up in other places if we try to look at symmetries or I don't know what. But in any case, the variation equal to zero. Did you get those properties?
Yeah.
You got the photo, right?
I think so.
So del F equals zero if and only if mod phi equals m squared. Fine. And then we can ask, you know, what our sign conventions are and whether that's the right sign. You know, what we want as a solution is something like a plane wave would be I over h bar k dot x minus, or that would be t dot x minus et, something like that, give or take that sign here. Then box of that phi is going to be equal to, let's see what's going to happen. We'll pull down an I over h bar squared, and then the time part, all right, minus two time derivatives is going to pull down an e squared, and plus two space derivatives is going to pull down a c squared. So we get something like this, which is minus 1 over h bar squared minus e squared plus c squared is equal times phi. So that e squared minus c squared is just m squared over h bar squared, or m squared c squared is really e over c squared here. Why is it e over c squared? Surely it is. Let's see. There's a ct here and a c there.
Cancel.
And these are with respect to x0 and ct, so we get that c. That's where it's c's not 1. H prime's here, 1, of course. But so with this sign convention, we want a plus sign here, but the sign convention I used here is the opposite to Maggiore, so maybe we wanted a minus sign there. We'll see what you guys find for me. But you want these oscillators. You want a plane wave like that to be a solution. Did I say any of that too fast? Everybody got it?
The only thing I'm missing is the EP MC squared. One of the signs seems wrong to me, but I'm not sure. It's just me being silly.
Bring this one in. So E squared minus P squared.
There we go. Okay.
That's the one you need?
Yeah, that was okay. It.
All right. So, let's see. Did it go at 4?
4:30 is what we're...
Oh, 4:30. Oh, okay. So we're good. Oh, great. I didn't do the necessary theorem in mechanics case. We're going to want to do that here, too. Let's first on do the Hamiltonian version of this, and then we'll go back, and in both cases, we'll do necessary theorem.
So, I have a question.
Yes.
This is, we haven't quantized anything, we're just talking about quantum mechanics.
Right.
What is the field?
Fine.
What is it?
Oh, what is it?
Yeah.
Skitter field.
Oh, well. Gosh.
I mean, x of t is a function that describes how the particle moves.
Where the thing is.
Right.
Yeah. Okay. Phi is, well, you know, it might be a measurable amplitude. Let's see, you know, this might be... If we wrote a slightly different Lagrange density here, it might be temperature as a function of position and time.
Okay.
There's a scale of two.
Okay. Okay.
Right. I mean, that's a classical thing, of course, but, you know, that's a scalar.
Right.
You know, and you get currents and stuff that, you know, carry the energy around. Let's see. Some other examples of... A field.
Can we do an electric field this way?
Absolutely. Okay. Yeah. Electromagnetism. All right. Well, let's do electromagnetism. You know, that's just what we do. Okay. Here we go. I guess this is yeah, exercise and example are kind of busy with something. You know, if I don't work out the examples in sufficient detail, good job. Anyhow. So here we in general we want to build the action out of derivatives of the field. You know, these are often potential. The thing one ends up thinking about in MS is a vector field. And we want to build an action out of derivative of that vector field. But we know, because this thing escaped dependence, that we really want to take a curl here, or else we're dealing with something that's not at all invariant. So this curl at least is a tensor. Mm-hmm. So this is pretty much the only tensor we can build out of the first derivatives of our field. And a kinetic term is typically quadratic in the first derivative. Just like x dot squared, half mm-hmm. mv squared, right?
Right.
Same thing works fine here. Works very well for a whole lot of even fundamental fields to take them to be linear second order equations. You can actually do an amazing amount with linear second order equations. Who knows why? That's what happens. So to make something Lorentz invariant, we want to square this thing. I think usually a normalization of about a quarter works really well. We do not want to add a mass for what's going to turn out to be the photon. So we don't add an a squared term here, although there's a thing called the Proca Lagrangian, where you do add a mass, and it's a vector field with a mass that looks in many regards like electromagnetism, but there's also some mass floating around. And you lose the gauge invariance when you introduce a term like that, but there's no reason not to write it down and say, well, are there fields in the world that look like this? No. So this is a perfectly good action functional of the vector potential. Okay, d4x. There we go. Right, so we bury that. So this is a free EM action. What are we going to get? Okay, I put this quarter out here. Why? Because I'm only going to get two of these. I'm going to have an F mu nu, but look what we get here. We have d mu del A nu minus d mu del A mu. Got to go. Okay. These two terms are actually the same. Who can tell me why?
Probably
you rename the second pair of indices using anti-symmetry of F.
Right. So you distribute the F into both terms in there.
Yeah. So right. You call this mu and this mu, then you're contracting on mu, because you've renamed them in the second term. But then you flip them, and now this term looks just like that one, but flipping gave you the minus sign, so it's plus, and that's where the 4 goes. So you end up with F mu nu d mu del mu equal x. You integrate by parts, throw away the surface term, and the derivatives come over onto F. And this is true for all del A nu if and only if the divergence of F mu nu equals 0. We didn't put in any source current, so that's this is the back of Maxwell equation. So, all right, here's the uncompleted part of example 2, making it exercise 2. generalize that so you add current to. Anybody see how to do it? Oh. Or do you want to do it for an exercise? Right. Yeah, let's do it now, but you guys have to tell me how.
That's what I had written. Well, we need another term.
Good. So now,
right,
we're going to add another term. Good. So we have a quarter F mu, and another term. What do we want to get? Anybody remember Maxwell's equations for vector form? What should be here?
The four current.
Yeah.
Right.
You know, maybe 4 pi over c. This thing is just charge density and current density. That provides the source for Maxwell. You know, probably rho over c if we're putting in, you know, factors of c and stuff. But yeah, the four currents. These are sources for electric and magnetic fields. So you want to get a j over here on the right side. How is that going to happen? Better have a J up there somewhere. Alright, there's again. So let's have a J up here somewhere. But there's got to be an A up there somewhere. So that when you vary the A, the J shows up in the equation.
Right.
So what do we take?
There you have.
Alright, so I'm going to replace all the A's by del A, and then the coefficient of del A is going to be my field equation.
Just put an A.
So just put an A.
Yeah.
Alright, so now this looks bad, right, from gauge invariance. This doesn't look good at all. But if I vary that, reflect a reader, but I think it's obvious, right? Del A, I'm just going to have,
right,
you know, plus
right.
J del A. I've got the minus sign from integrating by parts, so this is what I get. That's, we're done. We did it.
Okay.
What about gauge invariance? Okay, if I have J nu, A nu equals that goes to J nu, A nu plus the gradient of an arbitrary function before x. What happens? So I've got J nu A nu plus integral J nu du phi e for x. This is bad. That's just doesn't look so good. Any ideas what might make it right? Your field equation in the lower right corner. Take a second divergence on the new index. What do you get? So if I take d nu here of both sides, what does that give me?
Is that zero? Right, no.
Why?
Because it's anti-symmetric, right?
Mm-hmm.
So
mixed partials commute.
Zero. Right.
Mixed partials commute. So those two derivatives are symmetric. F mu nu is anti-symmetric. So
right.
This left side is identically zero. What's d nu j nu mean? D nu j nu equals zero. Recognize that equation?
Right, divergence of the current is equal to zero.
Yeah, it's a conservation equation. It's a
continuity
equation. It says that d rho dt plus del dot j equals zero. Integrate that over some three-dimensional space. This divergence goes to the surface, and what you find is, or let's see, how do we... Oh, let me just do this, actually important in its own right. If I integrate rho d cubed x
2 for the obvious reason. Then, if I look at dq dt, that's bringing the derivative inside the integral, that becomes a partial, because rho before you integrate depends on these coordinates as well. So now, the rho dt is minus the divergence of j d3x. We can integrate back to the surface, and we get the integral over the surface of j dot n d2x. So the time rate of change of charge in a volume d is equal to minus the amount of current flowing out over the boundary.
Conservation.
So it's nice that this follows automatically from the field equation. Current conservation is a good thing. We like it. Now, what about that gauge invariance thing? Does this give you any ideas?
What's the question again?
Well, we were looking at what happened to the J mu A mu term of the action when we change A by a gauge transformation. And we seem to pick up that second integral here. That means that this thing is not invariant. You know, we don't want this thing to be here. How can we show that it goes away?
More terms amount to, I mean, like the trick with the curl of the...
Yeah, it's a possibility, except, you know, I'm afraid we have to add minus j dot a. I don't know if anything else in the hand would actually do the trick. Integrate by parts.
I'll get a minus and get dot j.
This term is the integral of d mu of j mu phi over d4x, so the integral of the divergence, minus integral of d mu j mu phi d4x. So the integrated part, boom, current conservation spaces. So the only thing is some contribution on the surface, but we set all our field planning at the surface. You know, if in the worst case scenario, we could restrict ourselves to gauge transformations that vanish at our boundary. We could restrict that. We don't necessarily want current, so this remaining term is, you know, let's see, what is it? It's a three-dimensional integral over the bounding surface of gauge transformation j nu normal to the surface d3x. So something like that. Well, you know, if the surface is at infinity, we don't want our electrons running off to infinity and vanishing from all of space-time. So, you know, we could take the current to be zero out there. That's fine. If we're in some bounded region and we want to have the current entering or leaving the region, then that n dot j is not zero, and we better be careful what gauge transformations we do. We better make the gauge transformations vanish on the boundary of our region. And with that caveat on our gauge transformations, we're okay putting in these currents. Yeah, I'm not sure how you would that up otherwise, but probably the safest thing to do is take the boundary off to infinity. Then that term will vanish. So that's the maximal action right there. That's it. You can take a fine commission. You had shown that before. You didn't.
You also put in the action for the Dirac equation. Yeah.
What's that?
You included the action for the Dirac equation we did before.
Right, yeah, in the game theory class, we did the whole thing, right? In J was the current due to the Dirac equation. So, but you don't add that term just by fiat. You say, well, you know, what are the fundamental fields? And you actually do a gauging of a U1 symmetry of the Dirac equation. And when you put in a covariant derivative in place of the partial in the Dirac action, that covariant derivative A is the connection. So that term pops out automatically, but the J is built out of the Dirac field in just the right way. It turns out to be a conserved four current built from the Dirac action, conserved by virtue of another theorem, which is the next thing we need to talk about. I should put a big arrow from right to left up here. Have you done it yet?
Anything over here, or anything?
Anything in general.
I have a question. Yeah. Can't relate to this stuff part, but I do have a question.
Okay.
Yeah. I was talking to Jeff about this too. How do you show how the solder form transforms?
How the solder form transforms?
Right, right.
Well,
I guess in general, in the Poincaré group, right?
So, if we're still in the Poincaré group, the four gauges.
Right. How do you show how it transforms?
Then it's an ordinary piece of the connection. It transforms like every other piece of the connection. So you start off with, okay, you've got some matrix transformation for your group. Your connection one forms have some convenient labeling that lets you act on them sensibly like this. That'd be a lambda bar on that side, minus the lambda, let's see, what is it, the dB kind of thing? The lambda bar, the, is this the right sign?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. This is, this is good for any, this will work for conformal. This will work for anything that's a conformal. Because, we can take dB to be AB or A dot or dot A or dot dot. So, you know, the solder form we can see from that. Now, you asked about Poincaré groups. Let's do Poincaré groups. So these are local Poincaré transformations. And the solder form. Let me think about. How we're going to introduce these guys. We have Lorentz transformations, and we have translations. And if we choose a five-dimensional linear representation, we can represent all of these as some five-by-five matrices. So these lambdas are going to be these five-by-five matrices, where these are just Lorentz transformations. And then we have, A, B row, 0, A1, A2, A3 for our translations, and a 1 here just to keep things honest when we multiply by, XB and 1. So, XB and 1. So that's going to be our x tilde times 1 when we multiply it out. And so x tilde is lambda AB xd. There's the Lorentz transformation plus the translation because the 1 picks up the A, but that's our Poincaré transformation. So we've got them all. So now let's see, what does the connection look like? Well, so if we think of think of these things as our capital lambda AB. So, lambda AB is that matrix. Lambda AB and AA 1. And we're gonna write it as the identity plus an infinitesimal transformation. So we get our generators. What I'm hoping is that this is going to give me some Kudendeck label for my momentum, and I'll know what to do with it. This is what to do with it in general. Once I've got a pair of indices on my connection, and we know that's what we write for the Lorentz connection. But it's always going to be a DG G inverse. You're always looking at the action of a group on some generator. So you've got some generator here, some linear combination of generators, some particular combination of generators, and this is a new linear combination of generators. So that's how these things transform always. The connection one forms are going to transform in the same way. You always have an action of the group on itself, right? So and that gives you an action of the group on its Lie algebra. Let's see. Let me press on over here. See if I can get this solder phone to work. So we have some generators. Our Lorentz generators are the usual thing here. So these are going to be our MAB, and that is a matrix of whatever components that matrix has. The P generators. Are going to be these guys, right? A dot P, that's a matrix, and it's off diagonal, and so it's something is zero everywhere, but the A is sitting there, the A is sitting on that side. The A's are the parameters, and then the generators just have ones in each position. So now, our S1 AB guys are matrices that look like that. Those are our generators. So if we take a probably strip that off, but we want the inner product with some like labeled connection one form. And this is the one delta AB, delta AB. If we, let's see, here it's just a 5x5 thing. So, let's see. F1 AB, we can break into various parts. We have an F1 AB
we have S1A0, S1, 0B, and S1, or what do we call this, 5B, and 5. And those two are 0. So it's really S1A, B, and S1A, 5 that are going to have duals that are relevant to it. So we can think of the Monroe-Cardan equation as acting on an omega AB corresponding to dual to this S1AB. And then our PB or PA is dual to this S1A5. So we can think of it as an omega omega 5A is dual to epsilon B5. There. And then that gives us all the omegas. These are all the omegas, the others are zero. So now we've got a notation where we probably know how to do the transformation. This is a good question. I don't really I figured it out. You know, every now and then you have to figure it out. And, you know, I've done it before, but you know, it's nice to develop a uniform notation so you know what you're doing. And now I think we can, but we can just apply this formula where these lambdas are those guys. So now these are going to become local translations, local Lorentz transformations. So we can take D of them and all that good stuff. Let's see, I could call these guys lambda rho A column 5 of X. And now it seems a little clearer. So what I want is omega tilde 5A ought to be a lambda 5B, omega BC, lambda bar CA, minus D lambda 5D lambda bar DA. There's my transformation. So that lambda 5B, I want my 5s in the other place. I don't get any 5. Oh, I lost some. There's a 5 on the thumb has to go over everything. I'm sorry. This is B, capital B, capital C, capital C. There we go. Okay, so lambda 5 little b, omega little b, little c, lambda bar c a, plus lambda 5 5 omega 5 c, lambda bar c a, plus lambda 5 d omega c 5 lambda bar 5 a. Most of these are zero. Plus lambda 5, 5, omega 5, 5, lambda bar 5a. So that gives me four terms when I break it out. Are any of those non-zero? Let's see. This one's certainly okay. Let's see. We have a lambda a5. I'm a little worried about that. Oh, these are the full transformations. Lambda 5, 5 is one. This one survived. So, 5B is 0. 0. 5 is 1. 5A is 0.
So we get one of these minus b lambda phi b lambda bar b a minus b lambda phi lambda bar phi a. That doesn't seem right. I want the phi in the other place. Well, I'd like one of these inhomogeneous ones to survive. It doesn't seem to be surviving.
The one thing we were talking about earlier is that the solder form, the homogeneous term should go away, right? If we're talking Poincaré with the quotient of Lorentz.
Okay.
But without the quotient.
Now, the thing I'd like to see is that there is an inhomogeneous term in the full group before I take the quotient.
Okay.
After we take the quotient, the lambda A5s are no longer symmetries, so then we drop those. But I'd like to see a d lambda a5 showing up here. I'm a little worried I've got my indices in the wrong position because, See, what I want is, a5. See, I've got this down, and what I really want is a solder form with an index up and, you know, my PA. Dual to my PA. You know, this is the relationship that would seem to put my indices in the right position. But why does that work? See, this is row column, that's column five. My lambdas aren't working out that way. I don't see why. I mean, I sort of see why, but
Can we use properties of the covariant derivative to try to see how that transforms? I don't know.
Well, because the covariant derivative transforms covariantly.
Right.
We could get, if we write the Maurer-Cartan equation, this should be a solution to the Maurer-Cartan, or at least the last term. So it seems to me that, but what do we have? Maurer-Cartan for just the group. If we put in E tilde, or if we let A be pure gauge, we ought to have a solution. And it seems to me that the pure gauge thing ought to be a lambda d lambda a5 lambda bar five. Well, this is just a 1. So if I put d lambda a5 in here, this ought to work. Well, d squared of lambda a5 is identically 0. On the right side, we have d lambda b5. But then we need the omega tilde here, right? What's omega tilde? We need omega in terms of the gauge transformation. How's that going to work? So, omega ought to be a lambda a d, or no, d lambda a c lambda bar d b, something like that. I don't see why that's vanishing either. I wonder if it's tensor in the group.
What you were talking about, one thing is that it transforms with one of the lambdas, you know, like E A tilde is equal to lambda E or something like that.
Well, yeah, once we have only local Lorentz symmetry, we know it's just going to transform like a vector. It's just a vector. There is no translational symmetry, so we don't expect an inhomogeneous term for it. So we know a free Lorentz index is going to transform to the Lorentz transformation. So that's always going to happen.
Are you thinking it's going to transform this way because it's like a small vector or something, you know? Or we know how vectors transform under Lorentz transformation, so this is like an infinitesimal vector.
That's a plain old vector. I mean, it's a one-form vector. That's a free Lie algebra index there. And, you know, that transforms under the full group. That the Lie algebra knows, or the whole group knows what to do with Lie algebra indices. Don't worry about TA. It could be that I should be, you know, this doesn't look like a solid form, that A should be up. So I think maybe where I'm running into trouble is that, all right, I want P0 to be, you know, that matrix. And, you know, internal, you know, P1, all right, is going to be 0, 1, 0, 0, 0, that matrix, and so on. So
we had to run the
P down, these transformations with the A up are linear combinations of the generator with the label down. So I get something like this. So let's see. So PA. That's still row A, column 5. It's just not here. You know, if I look at suppose I were to look at A5 instead of 5A, whatever that means. I have a lambda AB omega B5 lambda 5-5. Let's see, what else? There's no 5-5. If I have an A here...
What about a 5-5-1 or something? Or?
What's that?
Well, lambda 5-5 be 1 somehow, or?
Lambda 5-5 is 1.
Oh, it is 1, okay.
Yeah, that's fine. So this is the one they expect.
Okay.
Let's see. I don't particularly want them to pick up the piece like that, however. That could be there in the full group, and when we throw these away, they go away. Let's see. B lambda A5, then this is lambda bar 5-5 is going to be fine. So this is what I expect.
Okay.
All right, that would be right.
Second term go away somehow.
Well, when we gauge, it does. Yeah. See, the 5-5 and 5-5 bar are 1. So we get our new, well, of course this is our solder form, right? This is looking like what I expect. So we get solder form B. this term could be here. It's possible a lambda A, B, omega, B, C, lambda, D5 would be there. Then minus D lambda A5 and lambda R5. So this is quite possible. There's no particular reason. If I do a translation and then a Lorentz transformation, you know, that extra piece that I translated is going to get rotated too. So there is some interplay between the solder and the rotation. That's not impossible. The thing that happens once we take the quotient, we lose translational and generalize the connection. We lose the translational symmetry. That kills lambda A5, so both these terms drop out.
So we're saying that this row becomes zero then? Or the A?
Yeah, we just set that to zero.
Right, okay. Okay.
Yeah, our residual symmetry group is just Lorentz. So, okay. Yeah, everything that's not Lorentz is zero, or that we can keep that one down.
Okay. And now, would there have been, would it have been possible to get this by, you know, sticking in like the form, like just sticking in the solder form of, in definition of the covariant derivative, because that's how we got this in the first place.
Right.
Right.
I don't know. Let's try to see. Let me try to understand what it is here.
All right. I can kind of show you.
Yeah. You know. Yeah. That might come out of there.
Right.
So we've got like covariant exterior derivative of E, this one.
Right.
Like that?
Is that what we're doing? Yeah, okay.
Okay.
Will that work? I mean,
find the thing in the box, so this is what we were talking about earlier, to find the thing in the box, what we did is we took the covariant derivative of a general vector, just one.
Right, that vector. And we use the spin connection as the Lie algebra valued one form in definition of the covariant derivative.
Right. We derived that from
covariant. Right.
Yeah. You know, the thing that's a little questionable about that is that the D of something that's not a tensor is not a tensor. Okay, so, you know, if I take a covariant derivative of a Christoffel symbol, I can do it. Maybe. I can do that, but it's not a tensor.
So my question, instead of sticking in omega AB, would we put in like a solder form right there and put a D of D or something like that? Or would that work? Or in the definition of the covariant derivative, we're taking a like a covariant derivative of a vector, right?
Yeah.
We put like D of, instead of E, we put like a V.
Yeah.
And we use omega as our Lie algebra valued one form.
Uh-huh.
Can we do the same thing and keep the V instead of the E, but actually put in like some kind of a, you know, E instead of omega in that equation? Would that work somehow? I don't know.
Tell me what you're right.
Okay. Like a D, okay.
Big D.
A V A equals D of V A minus...
Probably plus for contrast.
Oh, plus, okay. There's going to be some kind of a new... Right.
So we
but my question is... Yeah.
Oh,
could we put
you want to get an E here?
Right. But the indices don't match, you know. Like.
Well, okay. We can patch this up.
Okay.
Yeah. So we're up in the Poincaré group now. So we've got an index runs over A and 5.
Okay.
So D of a full 5 vector is going to be. All right. We better add. VB omega AB, where, you know, this is like the whole thing. So, you know, what is that? So D of VA is going to be D of V little a plus VB omega AB plus V5 omega A5. Is that the other one? And then D of V5 is D of D5 plus D omega 5B plus D5 omega 5B is that everything? So let's see. something here is a solder form.
Wait a minute. What did I do here? 5-5. So, let's see. Which omegas are zero? I think we want this to be a solder form, right? So that fifth component. Well, for all allowed sine vectors, that fifth component is actually a 1. So we get d of the 4-vector part is dVA plus dB omega AB, and it looks like we pick up a solder form here times 1. That's weird. I don't know what this means. dB5. Okay, d of 1 is 0. Then we get these guys are zero, so this is all
zero. Okay. Okay.
Which
V5 is 1, so D of it is 0. Omega 5B and omega 5 are 0. So
5-5 was 1.
In the full group transformation it is, but for their connections it's not.
Okay.
Which is that's
right.
The 10. So let's see. Yeah, there's a V5 sitting there. That's a sort of weird thing. What does this mean? So now we're going to do our covariance demand on this and see what happens. All right, let's try that. So we're going to demand that this very odd-looking covariant derivative be covariant and see what we derive for the transformation property.
Okay.
Okay. I like it. Well, let's see what happens.
Okay. Maybe some other time zone, yeah.
Very strange. C. at B prime, then we need our new omega here. Maybe this has the old omega. So have I got it? Is that this? So if I expand this out, lambda AB, these are capitals and lowercase, straight B, 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 plus B, B, omega, B, C, equals B, lambda A, B, A, B, plus lambda A, B, A, B, B, plus lambda, yeah, let's try it the other way, omega, tilde, A, B, lambda, B, 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 B. Okay, so this one ought to go away. And so then we want to solve for this one. So we want to invert lambda AB. So I want a lambda bar with an A down and something free up, or you say for D. So what we get is BC omega DC equals this is all backwards. Lambda bar D A D lambda. Here we're running into this funny order again. D D. Then here lambda bar A, well, this one at least looks right. C, C, C. Except, I did the wrong one. let me strip the C, the BC first. So we have lambda AB, omega DC, I'll strip it with a C, equals D lambda AC plus omega tilde AB lambda DC. Then this one I want to invert. So I'm going to multiply by lambda bar DD. So I get lambda AB omega BC lambda bar CD minus D lambda A, see this looks better, lambda bar CD equals omega tilde A D.
Voila.
Precisely. So, I see them.
Anybody speak French?
I don't. That's awful.
Trying to say exactly, or are they trying to say?
Yeah, precisamente.
Oh, preciso in Spanish. Close.
Yeah, that's worse than things, isn't
it? So how do we know what the omegas look
okay,
like?
Okay, so, yeah, like, so now we have to break these out, right, with primes and the lowercase and uppercase, like I did here. Mm-hmm. So let's see what happens. Now, do we know what the... I better keep track of what these lambdas are, so let me not erase that guy up there. Okay, so omega tilde AB. Suppose we choose, let's make it a B. Choose the two lowercase ones here. So A and B go lowercase. We have lambda A B omega B C lambda R B D minus the B becomes lowercase. The lambda A, C, and the bar, C. D. get that right. Now we want to fill in here. So we only have, all right, lambda AB, lambda A5, and lambda 5 5 is 1, lambda 5 A is 0. That's our transformation matrix. Okay, so now we sort of get everything here. we're going to have a lambda A, B, omega, B, B, lambda bar, B, B. No surprise there. We're going to have the lambda A5, omega 5, B. Okay, now, which omegas did we decide we have? These two are zero,
right?
Omega 5, anything with an omega up, 5A, omega 5, 5 are going to be zero. So I don't get this term. So this one's got to be a B. Now we could have a 5 here though. So lambda A, B, omega, B, 5, lambda bar, 5, B. And we have to ask about the inverse matrix for this thing. What that does. Is that all? So we have to have B here, so we can have B or 5. Then on this one, B, lambda, A, B, lambda bar, B, B, of course. B, lambda, A, 5, lambda bar, 5, B. A, 5, that's okay. I suppose we need the inverse to that thing. Lambda A, B, lambda A, 5, 0, 1. So lambda bar B, C surely works there. We want to pick up the zeros. Let's see. Like we just want a 1 here. that can't be right. So, you get that with zeros. So, it looks like we'd like zeros here. But then, there, this one's going to pick up these guys. One there's going to be okay. But here, we're going to need something. Let me call it delta B. So I multiply this out and I get Kronecker A C. That's good. I get 1 down here. Out here I get zeros. But what I get up here is going to be lambda A B delta B plus lambda A 5. So delta B is minus lambda bar BC lambda 5. So minus sign on the lambda with an inverse Lorentz transformation. Mm-hmm. Well, we need to invert it, unless you see a mistake in what I've done. So this is, right, lambda bar 5a is 0. This is lambda bar b, 5, is delta. So this guy is 0.
Oh, okay.
5a is this guy is 0. So that looks pretty normal. That's our usual Lorentz transformation. Good. We can be happy with that. Next. Omega tilde. What do we want? A5, that's the only other non-zero stuff, right?
Right. Mm-hmm.
So, this is our formula here?
Right.
lambda little a, big B, omega big B, big C, lambda bar, big C, little phi. Okay, lambda bar C phi, that's good to write. Then minus D lambda A capital letter, lambda bar, capital letter, phi. B5, that's all. So we have, so we have a Lorentz, omega B, C, lambda bar, B5. Then we can have, we don't ever get a 5 up, so this is, that one is never a 5. So we have Lorentz with omega D5, there's a solid form. Lambda bar 5, 5 is 1, so that survives. Then for this we have a D Lorentz, D lambda bar D5. Lambda bar D5 is something, actually. Then D lambda A5, lambda bar 5, 5. That's something. So, yes, we get all kinds of junk here. So, our solid form EA tilde is going to be a Lorentz transformation AB of our solid form with a 1. That's what we expect. And then we also bring in a little piece of the spin connection. This lambda C5 is a minus lambda bar C D lambda D5. So a norm, the transform spin connection with the translation.